Mayor Pro Tem Lee.
Here.
Councilmember Erickson.
Here.
Councilmember Morrison.
Here.
Mayor Winston.
Mayor Winston will be joining later for our later session.
Okay. Councilmember Tran.
Here.
Councilmember McGarvey.
Here.
Councilmember Planowski.
She will not be joining us tonight, thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Lee, you have a quorum.
Thank you, Devin. So next, we'll move into discussion items, general action items, and C1, starting with our presentation.
Good evening, Mayor Pro Tem Lee, members of the council. We're here tonight to continue our discussion on the new cannabis regulations, impacts to the community, and the role of local government. We have a group of guests here tonight, group guest speakers, to share their role and experience on this topic and answer some of your questions. First off, we have representatives from Hennepin County Public Health. Cassandra Steppen is the Public Health Promotion Supervisor, and Dwayne Hudson is the Environmental Health Program Manager. They're here tonight to share the county's work related to public health and prevention considerations and the regulatory framework local cities may consider on cannabis. We also have Officer Todd Kloss from the City of Plymouth to share his experience in this space related to public safety and law enforcement. Online, we have Dr. Robert Cole Perringer. Dr. Perringer is an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota, and at Essentia Health, he practices medical toxicology, addiction, and hospitalist medicine. I knew I'd messed that up. And finally, we have Dr. George Rilmuto. Dr. Rilmuto is a professor emeritus at U of M, Department of Psychiatry. Tonight, Dr. Rilmuto will share his experience related to exposure to cannabis on newborn child health and the effects of secondhand smoke. Wanted to mention out here tonight are representatives from the youth perspective. We did reach out to the Brooklyn Bridge Alliance for Youth, and they are not prepared to come tonight, but anticipate that they'll be able to share their findings of their youth engagement sessions related to the impact on cannabis sometime in December for the council. Some of our speakers tonight have a short presentation. Due to the setup here in the chambers, staff are suggesting each speaker sort of remain at the podium and stand for questions after the presentation so that we can maximize our time in the Q&A. The remainder of the time after the presentations, we can have each speaker respond to specific questions that may come up in their area of expertise as well. So without any questions at this time, I'd like to call up our first presenters, representatives from Hennepin County Public Health. Welcome, Cassandra and Dwayne.
Good evening. My name is Cassandra Steppen. I'm representing your public health department, and I have my colleagues here to help me answer any questions that may come up. As you know, this new law is complex and complicated in terms of just the sheer number of the 400 pages and all the details that are inside. But also, there's a lot that we just don't know yet. So I'm going to do my best to share with you our framework as your public health department and some of the things that we are prioritizing. But in addition to that, really utilize some of the knowledge that we have around commercial tobacco control and how that can prevent youth initiation and a lot of the policies can have a lot of the same protective factors here in this instance as well. So that's what I'll be sharing with you today. I'm not going to go through every single slide presented, but I will kind of cruise through the best I can. So when we started tackling the cannabis issue, we formed a work group internally to really think about all the different areas in which public health may be impacted. And we really wanted to come together to talk about the public health risks, specifically about well-being. We are in a mental health crisis, as many of you know. It's overwhelming in our student survey data. And we really wanted to think about what this may have an impact on the developing brain. We know a lot about commercial tobacco and how that impacts future risk for addiction. going forward and for mental health. The other big concern that we have is social justice and racial and health equity. So we wanted to make sure that we were really considering all of the components as much as we can within our system and with our recommendations going forward. The other part of our considerations here are really thinking through what does a robust regulatory compliance framework look like in our role. I mean, this can be one of the major contributors to prevention is having this robust framework in place, and so we really wanted to think about what that's going to look like for us, and we are continuing down that those conversations now. The last aspect is local funding, making sure that cities and kind of county have funding that they need to really do the operations of the compliance and regulatory framework, but also to adequately educate the young people and adult users. So as I mentioned, one of the things that we are the authority to we have the authority to do under this new Chapter 63 is for the county may issue a registration program in cases where the city or town has provided them consent for the county to do that on their behalf. So one of the things that we are working on, primarily doing here from environmental health, is reaching out to each of the cities to understand who is going to run their own programming or who may be relying on the county. So this is a major kind of taking up of setting up a program. And then the other point I wanted to make here is the education and prevention components. Prevention, so I'm in the area of health promotion, and our primary goal is to look at long-term chronic disease prevention measures. And one of those key levers that we have that we know that work is around policy and regulation. So that's primarily what I'm going to focus on today. I just want to start too with a couple of stats. When we are looking at our data, we do have some surveillance data, both at the county level and then some at the state level. But I just wanted to kind of ground us in this first, in that 6% of our youth are reporting cannabis use in the last 30 days. And that's according to the National Student Survey. And this is for Hennepin County, so our youth being Hennepin County. Prior to legalization of edibles in 2022 and now with adult use cannabis, we saw a downward trend of youth use in cannabis. So obviously we're keeping a close eye on that and trying to really pull all those policy levers that we can to really kind of stop that start, if you will. What's coming in from into public health is a lot of cry for help from schools. They are seeing a lot of, in particular, edibles and vaping poisonings happening with these edible, like hemp-derived THC products. So we're going to continue to watch that, as well as what the availability of these new products could have on our young people. The other piece is, in the data, use of marijuana and other substances is higher for those with mental health and behavioral or emotional problems. So again, we're in this mental health crisis with our young people, really kind of taking a step back and figuring out how do we get the right messages out. We are combating a lot of misinformation about the use or the safety of cannabis, especially in these high dose situations or products that we have now. The other thing of concern is that when we ask young people what they perceive as the risk for cannabis, it's very low. It's quite low, actually, and that is just kind of an example of the misinformation that we're sort of combating. And I'll also see another trend that we are keeping a close eye on is the young adults. So in our last SHAPE survey, which is our public health survey in Hennepin County, 28% of young adults, so ages 18 to 24, reported use in the last 30 days. So here's just a quick look at current marijuana use by race and ethnicity for our 8th, 9th, and 11th graders. So again, overall 6%, but you can see how that changes through throughout community here. This goes on to the perception, so little or no, you know, risk of risk perception here. So you can see that our communities that are reported using at a higher rate also perceive the risk to be a lot lower. For our adult population, again, 16%, and that's the little line across all bars there. And you can see that our 18 to 24-year-old age group is a lot higher than most areas, our age groups that we have. And this last data slide that I have here is just to represent basically what does that 16% look like in our adult use by race and ethnicity. Just also keeping the caveat here that some of these numbers because of the number of responses that we got in the survey could be unreliable or should be used sort of with caution too. Desegregated data is important to identify where folks are in the community. So with the legislation that passed, Hennepin County, prior to legislative session, provided a lot of comment about what we thought we needed to close in terms of cannabis reform. So there's really two categories of products here that we're going to talk about. One is these products that were legalized, these hemp-derived THC products that were legalized in 2022, and then also this adult use product that we have coming up for eligibility for sales starting in 2025. One of the things that we were able to obtain for local control is sort of this idea, similar to what we have done for commercial tobacco and alcohol retail, is regulating the time, place, and manner of operation of the retailers. The other strategy here that they permit local jurisdictions to take on is buffer zones around some youth-oriented settings, and then also regulating smoking and vaping of the products in public spaces. So I'm going to cruise through a couple of these slides here. They're there for you for later reviewing if you'd like. It's just too much information to share. The other piece that I wanted just to highlight here is that with the registration program, local jurisdictions are able to assess registration fees to cover the costs of a program. So this is an example of what those parameters are within Chapter 63. The other responsibility that locals have is conducting compliance checks, which I'm sure you've all talked about here. So those costs will be relied upon the cities to conduct and to pay for. So that's what the fees are really important. So there are three really great resources I'm going to make sure that the council is aware of, and they come from the Public Health Law Center and also the Minnesota Regional Prevention Coordinators. There are three webinars that really kind of lay out the marijuana landscape and public health options for local regulation. And the last is kind of the safeguards and further protections that the state and locals could take. I did pull out just a couple. Excuse me for going quickly through here because I'm running out of time. I wanted to pull out a few of the slides here to bring to your attention. So there's really two opportunities, like I said before. You have the authority, if you want to pursue it, to regulate or license, I should say, hemp-derived edibles. So those are the products that were first legalized over a year ago. That sort of will shift, I guess, in the new year of 2025, when the Office of, sorry, I have a terrible tip in my throat, cannabis, Office of Cannabis Management will be taking over the regulation of that. So it's a temporary authority to regulate edibles. What became legal as of August 1st is the use and possession of these adult use products. You can see what is legal here. So like I said, we can implement an interim ordinance really to take the time to study the time, place, and manner of restrictions, and also work to regulate the hemp-derived edible products. There are additional... there are additional authorities which are really important to youth prevention and addressing adult misuse of these products, and really taking advantage. These are not automatic. These are things that you have to enact. So zoning, density, hours of operation, and regulating on-site events, or cannabis events, if you will. So those are the four categories which we would strongly encourage folks to consider as a way to prevent young people from initiating cannabis use. The other place where you have the authority is protecting clean indoor air and some outdoor spaces as well. So you can see on the right, this is where the products are not allowed to be used. The one piece of this is a little untested yet, which is could be inhaled by a minor. So any location where smoke or vapor could be inhaled by a minor. Well, I'll leave it to your legal team to determine what that means, because that could really be complicated for a lot of folks. The other clean indoor, or the other air opportunities are really around outdoor spaces, so regulating your city property, parks and recreation, other sorts of maybe like patios, restaurant patios, and things like that that you can go ahead and regulate as a form of prevention. So I'm going to stop there. And this is our contact information. If you would like to know more about sort of the compliance program, but also any public health protections.
Thank you, Cassandra.
Yes.
I think we're going to take like a couple questions. Okay. So if anyone has any questions for Cassandra or the Hennepin County team, we can take a few now. Councilmember McGarty.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem, and thank you, Cassandra, for your presentation. I just have a couple of clarifying questions. I think it was slide 4 or 5, somewhere in there, you mentioned you had a list of, and vaping was on it. Did you actually say vaping poisoning, or did I hear you wrong?
That's correct.
What is that? That wasn't on the slide. The vaping was on the slide, but vaping poisoning was not. What is that?
Yeah, so it's kind of the Wild West with these new products that were legalized in 2022, and there's a lot of products that are coming in from out of state. And young people, we've done a good job in public health to stigmatize the actual like combustible product. And so vaping is much more popular, as I'm sure you're well aware, because you've all done some great tobacco prevention strategies centered around vaping. But this is also the case for these THC products, in that young people are going to the nurse's office in one school district. I think it was on a weekly kind of stint there for about a month where someone had overdosed. So that can look like a seizure. It can look like panic attack. I'm going to leave it to the docs in the room to really talk more about that. But yes, that is something that is happening.
Okay, thank you. And the second clarifying question, I think it was slide 8.
Okay.
You had use by groupings of people.
Yes.
wanted some clarification on...
Sorry, I'm not going to make anybody sit here by the changing slides.
Yes.
All right.
Could you just clarify for me, the largest use group here is U.S.-born black. Right above that is black or African-American. What is the difference between black or African-American and U.S.-born black?
Yeah, so you can see there's a color difference between the bars. So the darkest is the main group, and then we were able to pull apart some other subcategories from that. So 17% is the rate for all black and African-American reported adults survey, and then of that 17%, U.S.-born black is 28%, and foreign-born black is 3%.
Okay, so that doesn't mean that there's an upsurge of new American youth, for instance, that the children of new Americans from Africa or black that are it's just anybody that.
Okay. Yeah, so this is an adult self-identifying as a foreign born.
Okay, thank you. Those are all the questions I have.
I just want to consult with my colleague Lily. That sounds right, correct? Yes, okay.
All right, Councilmember Morrison.
Thank you. A couple of questions, though. Before I would like to piggyback on Councilman McGarvey's question, because I don't know if I understood what you said, the difference between African American and U.S. born black. So I'm still confused, because I don't think you said that. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Okay, so the survey is folks are self-identifying as, we have one category, black or African American, and then they're able to identify from there if they identify as U.S. born black or foreign born black.
Yeah. What does, in your perception of you, what does black mean?
That's a good question. It feels like I don't have the answer to really prepare. I would need to really consult with the EPI team to figure out how all those definitions work together. Or is this more philosophical question?
Yeah, I'm concerned that you're presenting here your slide. Black or African American. It's the first time in my life I ever seen that. I've been black all my life. And then U.S. born black. And I'm trying to figure out what is black and what is African American.
So those are two common phrases that we use, and so they're both presented here. I'm not sure that there is a difference in the survey as it's defined.
Okay, I respect that you're unprepared to share that information, but I just think it would be important when you mention it like that, because I don't know what U.S. born black or African American, the difference between the two, but I just think it would be encouraging to have that identified so we know specifically what category do I sit in? According to this, I'm black and I was born in the U.S. I'm African American, I was born in the U.S.
Yeah, so that would, you would be falling into the like blue category if you identify them that way. So it's not either or black or African American, it's, these are two phrases that people identify with, and so it's like, it's a category for folks to, I'm not sure there's a difference.
Sorry. Thank you, I'll accept that. Now, another question I had, when I can you go to the slides where use is allowable and use is not allowable?
Yes. I appreciate the thumb up or down, because that really helps me identify which slide you're talking about.
Yeah, go back one. Thank you. Now, my concern that I don't see here is that I'm thinking of people that live in apartment buildings.
Yes.
Who smoke marijuana, and it's seeping into other apartment people's apartment who may not smoke, period. So how are we regulating such an event like that?
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. So from what I understand in the last moments of this legislative process, there was an addition that does prohibit the smoking and vaping of non-medical cannabis in a multi-unit housing. And that, but that doesn't start until March 1st of 2025.
Okay, can you just repeat that for me again?
Yes, it's complicated. So, smoking and vaping, in March 1st of 2025, smoking and vaping of non-medical cannabis will be prohibited in multifamily housing by the state, according to state law. Now, you have the ability as a council to regulate where to go further than the state law when it comes to clean indoor air. So you could go further if you would like.
And this evaluation and survey that you took for all these different ethnicities, this is specifically for medical or regular?
Yeah, great question. So actually, when we are talking about cannabis, it is medical or otherwise. When they responded. So if they reported cannabis use in the last 30 days, it could have been, there's no distinction between medical cannabis or, for lack of a better word, recreational cannabis.
You say there's no distinction between the two?
No, the survey does not provide a distinction.
Outside of the survey, is there a distinction?
In terms of secondhand smoke.
In terms of recreational and or medical?
Can you say more about the question?
You speak as if it may be a difference in the county, and you look at it as a difference, but you're saying there is no difference that was asked in the survey. You didn't say was it recreational or was it medical?
Right, so in the survey, when the survey was implemented, the definition of cannabis, there was not an opportunity for folks to identify if they were using medical cannabis or recreational cannabis.
So what I'm getting at is all of those figures could say that was all medical if you don't have that information. How will we determine that if you don't have whether or not your survey included medical and or recreational? How will we determine the percentages at that point?
That information isn't provided in this tool.
All right, thank you.
All right, we'll go with Councilmember Erickson, and then we'll move on to the next presentation. If you do have further questions, we can circle back towards the end after the presentations.
Could you skip ahead to the next slide after this one, please? In the right-hand column there, it says, in any location where smoke/vapor could be inhaled by a minor. So one of the reasons for holding the session was for discussion of things like public parks, public property, so on and so forth.
Yes.
So my interpretation of this, maybe City Attorney could offer some guidance as well. I would assume that would mean that our discussion about smoking in parks might become a moot point based on this.
Mayor Martin. Go ahead. Great, thank you. So, Councilmember Erickson, and I will just say that the language in the bill is actually would be inhaled by a minor, not could be inhaled by a minor, which would is much more restrictive. So that's why there is the additional tool of making it a petty misdemeanor. I mean, a park is generally a place where children go, but you could have difficulties if you were to say everywhere in a park is a location where a child would inhale the smoke. But if it's like a playground, sure, would is more applicable. But
you do have the tool to make a petty misdemeanor in a public place, which would clearly, you could clearly include parks.
So we still have determinations to make regarding public spaces?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That was my only question.
I just want to point you to slide 11, if you will. So for the new products, just to distinguish what we're here, kind of distinguish what I'm talking about here. So for the new products, you all can regulate, or local jurisdictions can regulate the time, place, and manner of the operation, and then where a retailer can be in proximity to a school, a daycare, residential treatment facility, or an attraction like a public park used by minors.
Great. Thank you for that presentation. We'll maybe have some questions for you later as well.
Mayor Pro Tem, Council Members, next up we have Officer Todd Kloss from the City of Plymouth. Just pull up your presentation.
Yes, Todd.
If I have notes on here, am I able to do that? Or not too much, because there's a couple of things. I'll wing it. Hello, I'm Todd Kloss. I'm a police officer in Plymouth. In 2014, I moved out to Oregon where I got to live through a legalization out there. I was a deputy sheriff out there, was promoted to detective to combat the cannabis issue that was arising after legalization happened. So I have a little bit of unique background here. Where I can kind of present to you some of the things that I investigated and some of the issues and why my position was created. So, in Deschutes County, which is like in the central part of the state, it's about 200,000 people, biggest jurisdiction on the east side of the state, so we're kind of like a local hub out there. I was the first person to use marijuana tax dollars, or our county was the first county to use marijuana tax dollars generated from the new tax to basically be put into law enforcement to combat the issues that we were having. So what we saw in the beginning was a lot of confusion. What we're experiencing here, the questions you've already asked, would versus could, these are all things that are going to be ironed out in the future, I hope, but we're in for a ride, I believe. Here's just a brief overview of kind of what we all know. And I like to kind of poke fun at some of the things that I see out there. So right now, I'm a little bit upset that the state wouldn't listen. I worked with the League of Minnesota Cities to get some of this experience, but they never took the opportunity to talk to me. So there's definitely some things that I was advocating for. One would be like a higher tax, because I think, and the state is not giving any jurisdiction the option to opt out, and that is unique in the nation. In Colorado alone, there's over 50% of jurisdictions that don't allow any cannabis use in their cities. So it's coming to your city, and there's nothing you can do about it. When we're talking about every residence can have four mature plants, and some people say, well, how big can a plant be? And I love this picture. because this is one plant. This is a guy in Southern Oregon who was interviewed for High Times magazine, and he likes to grow one plant that can produce over 14 pounds just in one. So, kind of funny. And we do have a great growing season here, and better than where I was at high desert elevation. So, again, so I like to compare Minnesota to Colorado in a lot of ways just because of the population, but I also have a little bit of insider knowledge from how much like the state of Oregon consumed. So if we look at our population comparative, so Oregon has 4.2 million people, Minnesota about 5.7, and the state of Oregon consumed 174,000 pounds a year, is what they tracked. At one point, they were producing 2.2 million pounds because they over-licensed it and gave too many people licenses to grow. So the market tanked and prices dropped. But if we compare our population based off of what the consumers, maybe the West Coast has a little bit higher consumption rate, but you know, you do the math on it and you look at, you know, 1,500 pounds for wholesale, like high quality, indoor marijuana would be like 3,500 a pound. Right now, as it sits, we're looking at, you know, $350 to $820 million in a yearly market the state's looking at. And right now, with it being legalized, but we don't have storefronts doing it, the illegal illicit market is here and it's thriving because there's a lot of money out there. And I think the chief has also mentioned to me he's starting to see that in your parks now. So really the confusion started with like the public. So when I got into my position, I got to go through kind of our computerized CAD system, and I found out several locations were actually complained about by like growing operations. There were complaints on these places like several times, and they would just get called dispatch and they'd report it to an officer and they were confused. They didn't know the laws, just like we're all confused right now, saying what's legal, what's not, how big can a plant be, how does it have to be in public view. I mean, all these things are coming into question and nothing was really getting done. So they said, we need someone to like go out and dwell into these complicated laws, and that was me. So, and a really great resource for you guys would be Rocky Mountain High Intensity, or HIDA. It's the HIDA team. It's a federal drug program that tracks the effects of legalization in their state, and so I have some things I can present on that. So, in states that have legalized, they've seen increase in DWIs and fatal car crashes, increased youth use, juveniles starting younger, increased black market operations among border towns, and more people in jail for marijuana-related offenses. So here's like the last 2018 to 2020. Like this is the number of felony arrests that they've made. Second line down, 192, 237, 168 bulk pounds seized. I tried to find what Minnesota is seizing right now, and there's no information out there on a statewide deal. So you're seeing, like Colorado alone, their products going to 25, 29, 21 different states. And being Minnesota is surrounded by states that are all illegal, there's going to be a big push to grow and sell here. So some of the things that I see, why should we care, safety concerns, I'll just go through this quick. So this is like unpermitted electrical work that we were seeing in a lot of our grows. On the picture on the right, you see just extension cords that are being overloaded that are turning black and they're being burnt, conduits burning in there, so a lot of fire hazards. These are all pictures that I personally took in search warrants too. Again, more unpermitted electrical work, so you're seeing the ballasts up there that store the power for the lights. They can be overloaded, and there's a lot of power that you need to grow. So fires are very common. Black mold, and this was just outside of that last picture in the room, so other health concerns for working in that, and then obviously it's going on a product that's intended for human consumption. Toxic chemicals, so another part of my job was to basically have to present this to a jury to say this is why it's important, and this was one way that I did it. I got some grant money and I sent off some vape pens that were intercepted in New Jersey and came back with 10 failed toxicology reports, and Some of this stuff is not even intended for human consumption, so it's really concerning to see that in the product that people are using because it's never been tested on humans. And then these are the homemade clandestine labs. So marijuana that's trimmed basically has that shaped material is now being brought through a clandestine lab. So this is how you make this is a closed loop system. So you stuff the long tube on the right, stuff that in with the shake, you put it on top of the collection vessel, then you run butane or propane or hexane through that, and it catches in a collection vessel, and it turns into like a wax, almost butter, and that's off-gassing. And then this one being a closed loop system that goes through a cooling condenser, and then it recycles the gas. When these things leak, because they're using usually refrigerator parts and stuff that's not made for a corrosive material, this can happen. Explosions with these devices are very common. And a picture on the left is kind of like a finished product after one run through that closed loop system there. Why they put it in pizza boxes, I don't know. So you see a bunch of generic pizza boxes, it's a red flame. Increase in neighborhood crime, I took this, just Googled like raids. I think this neighborhood hits home a lot with the West Metro here and in our communities. This looks like a neighborhood anywhere around our places that we live and work. So this was a DEA operation, and I had access to my notes, but there was like 26 search warrants that were executed in one day, and these are the homes that they were growing them in. So usually it's like large unfinished basements as a target for illegal growers, and so they can go inside and make the indoor grow operation in the basement. This is close to $200,000. I mean, every search warrant that I did, were very common to have a lot of guns in them. So I just breezed through that so we can have some questions for you. Usually I can go a little bit more in depth, but pick my brain if you'd like.
All right, we'll take maybe a couple questions.
Yeah.
All right, Jay.
First of all, Officer Cross, thank you for coming this evening. I know coming to a visiting city and spending some of your evening is not probably the top of your list, but we really appreciate spending your time this evening. As you know, Crook Park, Plymouth, they're all in this process of trying to sort this stuff out and how to figure out the path forward. I guess my question is, you showed a number of pictures of growing illegal growing operations. Were those being grown and then sold at legal retail establishments, or were those being grown and then sold illegally?
Typically you want to get your product out of the state where it's legal because it's worth more, right? So if I'm growing out in Oregon, I want to get it to Minnesota, and I've actually had cases come to here where I got to call some of my former coworkers and say this is what's going on. So that's the goal of it, is to just get the most money. But a really good case of mine, one of my cases, they had an illegal operation and then they also had a retail store. Because that's how you make the most money, is that you truly want to have your own dispensary and your own growing operations and eliminate any middleman that you can. So those are the most successful dispensaries that you will see. And so if you can grow your own product, because it's pretty minimal to grow it. I mean, you're mainly paying for power, and then you want to get it into your storefront. Yeah. So, but we did, in my case, did have illegal or illegally grown marijuana going into a legal dispensary as well. And most states will admit that happens.
Right, Councilmember Erickson.
I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about the nature of the black market operations that you mentioned. You said it was common along the border. Was that people setting up low cost on the illegal states on the border?
Mm-hmm.
Or people running black market operations in the legal state to undercut the official dispensaries? Or both?
Yeah, both. So, I mean, if anyone in here has property in Stillwater, I'd be interested in being an investor because that would be a great place to go set up shop, being that you're close to Wisconsin, right? So the busiest busiest dispensary that we had in Oregon on the east side of the state was right on the border of Idaho, where we had Boise population community. So that's like when we say border towns, you're also looking at, for illegal operations, you want cheap property, cheap warehouses to convert into grows. So impoverished areas usually are targeted for the illegal operations, but as for like a dispensary, they want to be in that border town just for their sales.
And then did you see black market operations slowing down over time or increasing, or was it just pretty much consistent?
Yeah, so they really had no idea what to expect when I first started the position, and I was basically given a laptop and a unmarked vehicle and said, go see what you can do. I was one person. I got, like, the county only got like $500,000 a year from tax that generated, and I had to compete against four different avenues like public health, treatment centers and schools and law enforcement were the only ones that could get that money. And so I was getting like $260,000 of that, and all the other operations went. And so I started off one person. I started collecting more because I was producing a lot more. I did 26 search warrants alone in the first 2.5 years. So that's, I mean, when you're, that's significant. My asset seizures were close to like $1.2 million. And so, you know, you start looking at like how much you're getting out of that one position, and it makes sense. But the state then decided to take all of that tax money and say now it has to go to drug treatment. So the state has their hand in all of it, and now they say no more funding for law enforcement, no more funding for schools, no more funding for public health. They said we want it all going to drug treatment. And so we lost out on it, so now it's that was the county's position to fund my position, another two positions, and now they've actually added a third position to it. So it's continuing to grow. I mean, black market operations, we were just invited them in with the legalization and the confusion and the beginning parts, and that's what I fear is going to happen here in the state.
Thank you.
Councilmember Morrison, and then we'll move on to the next presentation.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation and coming up to share this information with us, to educate and enlighten us on your experiences. Now, you showed some pictures of some homes. You said it was part of a raid or something of that nature,
mm-hmm.
and they all look to be a suburban community.
Mm-hmm.
So share that suburban community to a poverty community that you said they look for low buildings, so I'd like to see anything there.
Yeah, absolutely. This presentation was originally for the city of Plymouth, and so I wanted to definitely make it relatable to that city, because that looks a lot like what we have. And so the impoverished areas, like where I worked, were basically like destined land and just vacant farm fields and things like that. We got invited to work in all different areas of the state because they didn't have like marijuana specialty assignments. And so some of these like cartel operations come in and they can put up 15, 20 greenhouses in one weekend, basically, and have it all set up and running in a year. So it's different. But yeah, as for like in impoverished areas, just anywhere that you can grow it cheaply is what I feel is going to be targeted here.
And your definition of impoverished mean poor, burdened, troubled communities?
No, I just think that's where they target is wherever you can get any cheap electric, you know, even power grid can go into an effect, you know, like how cheap is your power, but then how cheap is your workforce, how cheap, you know, you have to hire a lot of people to trim your product, to get it packaged the way you want it. So yeah, they come into a lot of those areas and just basically look for cheap place to land, to rent, mainly like warehouses and things.
You know, my last question is pretty much around the same thing. based on low-income, poverty-stricken, and most burdened communities. What's your perception about the sale, the transition, the growth in that area? Because I didn't see that in your presentation, or you didn't identify that in your presentation. Higher, greater, or lower?
In what regards? I'm sorry.
In regards to the sale, in regards to the manufacturing of it, and or I guess the transactions within those particular communities that I identified.
Yeah, I guess I can't really speak on just my experience of writing the search warrants and do it. Like, there was never, there were homes were a certain value. There was very few search warrants that were completed. Now, occasionally there were, but most of my search warrants that I executed were land was cheap, where home prices were lower. And so that's kind of what I talk about. When I talk about impoverished areas, I think they are going to be targeted here in the state where people can come in and grow the cheapest that they can. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Well, okay, I'll just go so we can move forward, but thank you, and I'll come back.
All right. All right, well, have one more question from Councilmember Tran.
Thank you. My question for you is, with your experience, your career experience, and you can see that the how do you balance? How do you see the balancing of benefit and harms of legalizing marijuana to the future of America?
Yeah.
The young people, lose their trouble thinking, concentrating, learning ability, effective, and slower reaction affect the survival skill and affect the ability to learn, intellectual. How do you see the futures? How do you balance the benefit and the harm? Which one is more heavy?
Sure, and yeah, that's maybe a little bit out of my realm, but I'll just share my personal belief on it. Like, just looking at how it was a Schedule I drug for so long, there's not a lot of research that we have on marijuana, and so being it's still federally illegal, I don't think we have enough to say. So I think the states that are doing it, I think you can go back and look at what's worked for some and what's worked for not. And I can tell you, like, Washington State has some of the highest tax. It's like over 30%. They have a lot more funds to tackle some of these. Right now, the state is only having an 8% tax, I believe. It was, I think, originally pitched at 6%, which is going to generate a lot less funds to tackle some of these problems. And so my biggest thing would be when the state is dictating how the cities can, like, you can't even opt out of this program, you're going to want to get more money out of the tax dollars so that you can govern it the way you want. So I would advocate for that for you guys as a city. And I would also advocate that if this was not a general election that was put out there. This is also very rare. Most states have had a general election on legalization, and it narrowly passes. But so I also think there are going to be a lot of these problems that come up, and when they do come up, it shouldn't fall on the city, it should fall on the state. So if you have an illegal grow operation in your jurisdiction and you're dealing with 2,000 to 20,000 plants and you have a police force that's already low staffed, and I would put pressure on the state to have someone come out and take care of that problem in some ways. And so that's my biggest takeaway on this, because if you think about right now, the state law says if you have 23 plants or more, that's a felony. 23 plants, if you look at it from a criminal prosecution standpoint, you have to have that as evidence. So if you do 5-6 search warrants a year, and you're holding on to a couple hundred plants as evidence, think about your property inventory, your police departments. Think about if you seize 2,000 pounds like I have, and I have to now outfit Connex boxes, put them alarms, like, are your police departments set up for that? So when these issues come up and you hear from your local jurisdiction about the issues that you're having, I would encourage you to reach out to the League of Minnesota Cities to voice these concerns and put pressure on the state to come up with a plan to solve them.
Thank you for your, very knowledgeable answer.
Yeah.
I believe that we will learn more in the futures, because right now we already have problem of criminal activity. So with this DUI and, more criminal activity increasing, and we will learn more in the futures.
Yeah, and I will.
And I hope the scientific facts will give the government, a lesson how to deal with this. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief.
Mayor Pro Tem, can I just ask one question of our guest, just because I think it pertained to a couple areas that we had talked about? And my question would be for him to answer is, one thing we've heard from the state, and anecdotally, that legalizing marijuana will then, greatly reduce the black market. And what I've heard from other states in Colorado indicating that, in fact, because the THC level is so regulated by the state dispensary, that the black market continues to thrive because that THC level is higher. And I wonder if you can speak of that, if there's any truth to that, or if you have a perspective on what the black market looks like after the legalization and the dispensaries are up and running.
Yeah, and typically, like, when black market operations, like, there always will be, because most states have a 21 years of age requirement. So juveniles are still gonna get access to it. And that is all sold. And price is always dictated. I mean, a lot of the people that currently smoke marijuana and have, even while it's been illegal, still have their connections that they have, and they will get that cheaper than going to a dispensary as well. So there are operations here, they're running, and they will continue to run.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Our final presenter tonight is Dr. George Morgoto.
Thank you very much for this invitation. I am George Ramiro. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I worked at the University of Minnesota for 41 years. I'm now retired. I have been following this cannabis journey since Ryan Winkler was the author a couple of sessions ago. After hearing what the council has been presented, I'm just overwhelmed with all of the solutions you're going to have to find. But I'm not talking about the administrative issues that have come up or the legal issues. I'm talking about the people, person, clinical harms that I have seen as a clinician, and the research that I have done looking at the neuroscience of cannabis. The problem, so I'll go cut right to the chase. We already have a child mental health crisis. And COVID contributed to that, kids being not around teachers and other mentors and other individuals who could shape their social and social and emotional development. That contributed to this. But here's something you can't solve. How many child psychiatrists will graduate from the University of Minnesota Department of Psychiatry, Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Department? this year. One. We already have a shortage. There was a survey recently done that looked at access to a psychiatric bed across the country. Only 10% of children who were considered a danger to themselves or others, so very high bar, not because they were ill in other ways, imminent danger to themselves and others, only 10% had an available bed within 72 hours. The rest waited in and boarded in emergency rooms for weeks or months waiting for a psychiatric bed. I don't know if the council can solve this problem. Another point about, that's been raised a number of times, is the city opt-out provision. I have relatives in Michigan. 90% of the municipalities in Michigan opted out. We don't have opt-out here. I was the medical director for the State Hospital for Children and Adolescents for a dozen years. I treated adolescents who were psychotic as a consequence of use of cannabis. Where did they get that cannabis? The capacity of farms to grow lots of cannabis, that's been seen all over the country where it's legal. They produce a lot of it. They have to sell it. They want to sell it. And they sell it where they can legally, and they sell it where they can't in the illegal market. And that has been true for every state who has legalized recreational cannabis. In my role as medical director for that state hospital, I took cases in Wilma. I took cases from Prairie Care, Abbott Northwestern, United Hospital, Fairview, for cases that were psychotic, who are not treatable in psychiatric units. That means there was a child psychiatrist who saw psychosis and treated it the usual way that psychosis is treated. I happen to know a lot about the treatment of psychosis. I was the first person in the United States who wrote the paper on the treatment of adolescent psychosis with medication. It turns out the use of those medications does not work very well for cannabis-induced psychosis because the endocannabinoid system, which is what cannabis stimulates, produces its own kind of psychosis, which is different than schizophrenia. We have treatments for schizophrenia. We have first episode psychosis programs in Minnesota. NAMI has been very aggressive in getting state money for that. These cases don't respond in the same way. So I was treating these cases with the medications that were available, with psychotherapy, with educational therapy, with social work, bringing in the family. They were there for months. What will happen? I'm not going to even pose that question because you can see where I'm going. Okay, so I was going to present a number of things. The schizophrenia and psychosis caused by cannabis to adolescents and young adults. Depression and anxiety caused by cannabis to adolescents and young adults. Cognitive impairment. I got to mention something about this because it's a really magnificent study in New Zealand. They had a cohort of thousands of young people, adolescents, and they looked at their IQ over time. The difference in IQ between someone, an adolescent who smoked regularly and that ones who didn't, was one standard deviation, which means 10 IQ points. That difference continued, and they followed that group up to age 38, average age 38, and there's still a difference in cognition between the regular cannabis smokers and the non-smokers. Addiction, 6% of adolescents based on the student survey already report using cannabis on a regular basis. 9% of that 6% will have a cannabis use disorder. Those that use regularly, it'll be 17% of that 6% who will have a cannabis use disorder. The capacity of this state already is very short for depression, anxiety, psychosis, OCD, all of the kinds of conditions that need to be treated inpatient. We already have a shortage of beds. Okay, so the thing that I think maybe you can have some effect on is secondhand smoke. There was a study of pregnant women who use cannabis. Sometimes they use it because they early on in pregnancy, you feel nauseous and they're looking for something, and they have used cannabis. They took that group, and there was those that stopped using cannabis at the point that they realized they were pregnant, and those that continued to use cannabis, even though they were pregnant. Outcomes were followed after those kids were born, and the difference between the two groups is cognitive difficulties, emotional difficulties, and behavioral difficulties between the two groups. So, secondhand smoke for pregnant women, it's a toxic effect on the fetus. There was another study that looked at secondhand smoke among families that had toddlers. They studied the two-year-olds and looked at their development, cognitive, emotional, and behavioral difficulties. They looked at that two-year-old group when they were in middle school, cognitive, behavioral, and emotional difficulties. Why is that happening? It's because of the effect of cannabis on the endocannabinoid system and what the endocannabinoid system does for neurodevelopment. It puts cells in the wrong place. It creates neural networks that are odd problematic. It affects the frontal cortex so that things like problem solving are damaged. It affects the memory so that learning in school is impaired because memory is important when you're in school. So the endocannabinoid system is influenced by external factors such as cannabis, and because the brain is plastic among individuals up to 24 years of age, abnormalities are developed in those brains. We used to think it had to do with genetics. Only people with a genetic history, a family history of these mental health disorders would be at high risk. That's not true. It is the endocannabinoid system that is influenced by cannabis that influences neurodevelopment that causes these difficulties, whether you look at lactating infants, toddlers, middle schoolers, adolescents, the outcomes are the same. It affects those areas. The number of kids who will need special education will increase as a consequence of recreational cannabis. I think those are the points. Just one more point. These are problems, mental health problems. The technology that we use is helpful. The fact of psychosis leads people to be thinking things that are not true. They have delusions that they're going to be hurt. When you're in that desperate state, you will do things that are harmful to yourself. And so there's a person in this audience whose child went to Colorado, got a cannabis card, a medical cannabis card, became psychotic, attempted to get help, fortunately went to an emergency room. There were no beds available. There's no beds available already in Minnesota. Was discharged and killed himself. That's not the only one. I know of two other cases. One happens to be my daughter. So this is personal, this is clinical, this is neuroscience, and we will be creating a mental health epidemic on top of the one we already have. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you so much, Doctor, for sharing your insights. We'll open up to council for questions for the doctor as well as any of the other previous presenters. I see Councilmember Erickson.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify, when I had invited Dr. Perringer to be with us, I was anticipating that this would be a panel discussion, not a series of presentations. Dr. Perringer had to leave to take care of some family matters, so he's no longer available to us. My question would be, I think the science is very clear about cannabis-induced psychosis, clear about, generally speaking, using substances around two-year-olds is probably universally agreed upon as a bad idea. The fact of the matter is that the law has passed, and we are now obligated as a society to do the best we can to mitigate problems. And so I guess my question for you is, moving past the perhaps the ideal or the hoped for outcome, we're now dealing with the real that's in front of us. So I guess this is open to anybody, but clinically speaking, or public health-wise, are we aware of communities and states where this has already been lived experience for a while? Are we aware of helpful models of, let's say, how to educate parents about securing their stash? How to hold parents accountable when they fail to do so? Public education around, in the schools, like reality-based, going beyond the drugs are bad, but into the neuroscience 101 for an eighth grader. Have we seen any of these models be successful in other parts of the country? Practical things that we as a community, whether it's a city or a county public health department, can implement to deal with the real rather than the wished upon outcome.
Yeah, you're paddling upstream. Once you make it legal, adolescents say, if it's legal, especially when it became medical cannabis, it must be safe. That is their conclusion. Cannabis must be safe. Their understanding of their own neurodevelopment is very poor. I left out some of the studies that show MRI changes and other receptor changes. It's really dense. That's a good question. Neuroscience 101 for adolescents. That curriculum would be very interesting to look at. If this council can do something, it would be to put a cap on potency, because second to regular use is use of high potency cannabis. If you can regulate those dispensaries to keep potency under 15%, medicinal cannabis, the potency of medicinal cannabis is 15%. But farmers will grow 60, 70, 80% THC because they can. They can genetically modify their product to produce that. But if you could cap it in your dispensary, you would be saving a lot of lives and a lot of harm.
Unfortunately, at this time, products are regulated exclusively at the state level. The options that cities have related to dispensaries are limited to limiting the number based on population. And then, as presented in the Hennepin County presentation, there are certain time, place, and manner, including zoning buffers, but there's not the ability to limit potency of, not an ability to regulate like types of products from the city level.
Okay.
As currently in the law.
Looks like Cassandra has something to say. Sorry, Council, I spoke too soon. It looks like we still have one presenter left online. So if we can keep our questions short. That's it. Okay. So then, never mind. Resume.
Okay. Just to comment on a couple of questions that have arisen. One is, I wanted to say that today, actually, the Office of Medical Cannabis released an opportunity for public comment to comment specifically on potency. So while you don't have the authority to regulate that, you certainly can make a big contribution by submitting a comment to that process. I know Hennepin County will prioritize, public health will be prioritizing high potency, because I could not agree more with the doctor over here about high potency and the deception that there are low potency hemp derived products is not true. These are high potency products as well. I also wanted to just kind of hit on something that maybe I didn't hit strongly enough on earlier, which is really the opportunity that the new authority has to regulate zoning and density, but also some other opportunities like content neutral point of sale signage that would apply to, you know, anything, redemption of coupons and like BOGO deals and things like that. The reason why I bring that up is because the science is pretty clear for the experiences of those, you know, that have looked at the impact of what a retail environment does to increase youth initiation, but also prohibit folks from quit attempts, successful quit attempts, if you will, no matter the product. So if you're looking at commercial tobacco, if you're looking at alcohol, if you're looking at cannabis, all of these things are true. It is a really important tool for locals to be able to leverage the location and density of these that Chapter 63 allows us to do, because there's a direct line to how the number of retailers or how close in proximity one lives to a retailer and how that impacts young people and adult users attempting to quit. So in terms of the solution, that is within your control, and I cannot emphasize that enough.
Thank you.
Can I ask one follow-up question? This might be a question for law enforcement, maybe.
the black market product that you're confiscating from parks, from dealers, whatever, is any of that tested? What's the normal potency of the street stuff right now? Or Dr. Budo would probably know that too.
Yes, I do have that. It depends where you are. Depends where you are. London, it's higher. Amsterdam, it's about, I think it's 15% to 20%. I don't know what the street level products are in the United States.
Mayor Pro Tem, council members, I don't either, actually. Lion's share of it does not get tested. We field test as positive, it's a misdemeanor. It never goes to a BCA for an actual test for potency, so I couldn't even tell you, not tracking it. I will tell you that I'm aware that the THC cartridges are the ones that are at the highest potency and sought after when they talk about the highest level of potency, but that's really anecdotal, and that's all I can really tell you.
The concentrates are 60% or higher. And education and prevention, there is money in the law for education and prevention. Here's what it is: $10 per high school student. It is higher, $40 for pregnant women. So you'll have some money, but it's not a whole lot of money for that purpose.
Thank you. Next, we have Councilmember Morrison.
Thank you. My question is for the county. After hearing the professor speak and enlighten us on all of the causations of psychosis, and especially in our youth. So I'm concerned now, have the county embraced that fact, those facts, and we allocating ample funds to treat those affected youth, adolescents? We brought us a presentation on education, educating adolescents, but now are we putting money in a pot to treat these same individuals preparing for this epidemic?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So what's happening right now, I can tell you that there's a coordinated effort between Human Services and Public Health.
Please speak into the
microphone. Oh, yes, sorry. There's a coordinated effort between Human Services and Public Health to look at the gaps within our internal systems. So that assessment is going on as we speak. So that is really looking at a couple of things, identifying the risk factors and warning signs to detect early use for those that visit our public health systems. So those clients that come in to use our public health systems. So resources are being allocated there, I guess, in terms of human resources. The other part is for the education that you talked about. So those funds are going to be coming out of MDH, I believe, in 2025. To my colleagues here, is it 2025? And the funding is based off of the number of retailers. Okay, thank you. Yeah, so here's the appropriations that we can expect. So $5 million, this is statewide, to MDH for youth education grants. And so those will come to, I don't know if it's competitive or allocated, to local public health to administer youth education grants. The MDH is also allocating $2 million for grants to educate pregnant and breastfeeding people. Those are the two opportunities that the doctor talked about. Then there's $10 million for local and tribal health departments. These dollars, we don't know how they're being allocated yet, so I can't give you a number. We haven't received any sort of further clarification on that. So right now what we are doing is what we can within our existing resources. We work in schools already and utilize the existing curriculum that we have and offering that to the schools.
Can you respectfully share with me the efforts in the schools that you guys are implementing?
Yeah, so a lot of what we do in public health, which is going to be different than maybe a counselor. In public health, we partner a lot with schools on kind of train the trainer models with the staff. And so getting them up to speed on what are, you know, common misinformation that we've all heard tonight about the potential risks for young people, and also ways to identify use or addiction with their students. So that's where we are right now. The curriculum piece is actually coming out of the Minnesota Department of Education, but not until 2026, pardon me.
Two-part question. Are there any consideration, I'm just thinking that if the county and the school board established a platform, an auditorium, that made students a mandatory attendance to provide them with that information, that we're doing a positive thing, but then after they leave, it's their choice of decision to utilize it or not. So I'm just thinking about that effort to assemble a mandatory class to try to educate them on harmful and causation effects of vaping and all of the other plethora of things that comes along with utilizing cannabis.
Yeah, I agree with your line of thinking there. We don't have the authority to like mandate that. The schools operate on their own, right? But we do definitely want to put resources, these prevention resources, into that sort of education as well. So the curriculum and plus, you know, some of these engagement opportunities as well.
And then I just want to pick on the funding to be allocated in 2025 and 2024 is not even here yet, and 2023 is not even ended. And then you just mentioned something about 2026 as well.
Sure.
And then the dollar value that you shared for the entire state of Minnesota, $5 million, don't really meet the needs that we need in the whole entire state of Minnesota. So that informational piece for $5 million, I don't know how far we're going to go along with that. I just think that's not enough to educate these youth on the harmful effects of vaping and secondhand smoke and on using tobacco. So I don't know how we increase that, unless it's a voice that we extend to the county and to the state to say that's not enough, because it'd be more money to take care of those students who are impacted by inhaling and smoking. And if we're not putting dollar values in there correcting the problem, we're actually looking for something to explode right in front of us and not paying attention to what the possibilities and potentials that could happen. And so that's why I was asking about, are we putting monies and dollars into that area to take care of these same people who may have decided to go down that path? So that's important to know that we got some parameters in place to help deal with some of these issues. So, did you answer that question, that we had dollars in place to deal with that?
So we're using existing resources in the current relationships we have with schools to go in and do training with the adults in the school setting, so they can bring the information to their school communities. We don't work, public health doesn't work directly in that way with students.
And I'm speaking also about the county, you're representing the county. So does the county have dollars available set aside for the treatment of the same?
I am not aware, I can't answer that confidently. I have not seen any for public health education. I can't say that for other parts of the county, to be honest.
All right, thank you.
Councilmember Chang.
Thank you. My question is for Dr. Joel?
Yeah, just take one.
Yes.
My question for you, because right now we're still learning. I hope that in the future, the government will do a careful study of the how much we earn from legalized marijuana and how much we pay for the mental problem causing from addiction, from secondhand smoke, more elderly, pregnant women, children, asthma people, and the most important thing is our labor workforce will be weakening when the addiction start to leave the workforce and we lose the taxation from the people that been positive contributing to the national system. It will be weakening with more addictive. So what is your advice for the system, the public, the government system to deal with that?
Thank you for that question. Cannabis is in, recreational cannabis is in 24 other states. So when this bill was going through the legislature, the question was, well, we're learning from these other states. We have the lessons learned. Well, to answer your question about taxation and costs, it's for every $1 gained in taxes, this is already a study. We already knew this. For every $1 in taxes, we spend $4 between public health, auto accidents, mental health, and addiction. The cost is $4, the gain is $1.
Thank you. So that's not a gain. This is not about how that's going to work out. Yeah, that's not a gain. And I just want to add more. This is the history, the war history. When England invade China, the Chinese people, they fight very strong. So they use marijuana to weakening the country fighting. A lot of young people start to smoke, and that's how they can stay as long as they could in China. And the French colonists did the same thing with Vietnam. A lot of non-Vietnam people got addiction. So we still don't learn the history of the past. I hope people, in the future, since marijuana legalization, the government will do a study and will calculate the benefit and the risk, how much we earn from legalized marijuana and how much we pay back to treat for mental problem, for addiction, for crime increasing, for the a lot of child stillbirth and the children lose ability to learn. We as a country will lose the intellectual team from the young people, the education.
Councilmember McGarvey.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem. I don't have a question, I just have a request of the doctor. Would you please provide that study that shows $1 earned equals $4 spent on it? Thank you.
All right, Councilmember Erickson, did you want to say something?
Just follow on. I believe that the revenue to treatment cost analysis is similar.
Oh, sorry.
Microphone. If I'm not mistaken, I think the tax revenue to treatment cost ratio is about the same for alcohol, which has been legal for much longer and has no signs of being repealed either.
Oh.
I was just going to, Mayor Pro Tem, members of the council, just going to wrap up our speakers, thanking them for coming tonight. Unfortunately, Dr. Pieringer had some audio issues at the beginning online here, so unfortunately couldn't connect there. Happy to share all of the presentations, all the information that was discussed tonight with the council to make an informed decision moving forward.
One more question, and then I'll also say a couple things. Councilmember Morrison.
The police officer Brass McConnell already. My question was okay, thanks.
Thanks very much to all of the presenters today. Really appreciate your knowledge, your spending your time to come and inform us on your experience, your background, your insights. That's really, really appreciated. We'll have to, talk a lot more about what we can do. And unfortunately, not the full council is here tonight, but, we'll get the information, we'll go over it. And then for me, looking at the demographics, hearing about the, potential hazards and dangers, I think we really need to be able to do what we can to protect the most vulnerable communities, especially our youth, and maximize our leverage politically as much as possible to be able to help us do that in the future. And maybe it sounds like over the next year or so, we'll have the opportunity to continue to contribute to how the Office of Cannabis Management and maybe other regulations are also forming, so then we'll continue to stay engaged there as well. So again, a very big thank you. This was very helpful. And with that, we will move on to C2, racial equity principles.
Short break.
All right, a short break has been requested. 5 minutes. Thank you, everyone.